This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Checker Finn always chuckles when I say I wanted to be a little bit older before I became a voice of history in this work.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-hosts, the Adele and Beyonce of education reform, Suzanne Tatchney-Kubak and Alyssa Schwenk.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Alyssa.
I feel like you've called me that before.
I thought I called you Adele before. Suzanne's Adele today. You get to be Beyonce.
I get to be Beyonce. I'm good with being Beyonce.
Yeah. And Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you for having me. And I'll take either Adele or Beyonce. Mm-hmm. I've never been called either one.
Yeah. There you go. Yes. Even Adele thought that Beyonce should have
won. She should have won. She was robbed.
Okay. Hey, everybody. If you don't know, Suzanne is executive director of the Pi Network. Now, here's the thing. Pi is not actually about pi, though we have tricked many people into coming to our conferences by thinking that is the case. Suzanne, tell us, what is the Pi Network? First of all, what does that stand for? P-I-E.
Policy Innovators in Education. Okay. As American as apple pie.
Very nice. And it's a network.
It's a network of 77 organizations from 34 states and D.C. with almost 20 now policy partners from across the ideological spectrum who agree on a broad set of values and beliefs for reforming education, but not always, as you know, from as one of our co-founders, on the deep details, which is what makes it a rich group of folks.
I mean, this is basically education reform's big tent, kind of an umbrella group to bring these folks together a few times a year and talk about how things are going, strategy, tactics, policy. Mm-hmm. What's amazing, as you said, so we now have education reform organizations in 34 states plus DC.
And they're all organizations working at the state level. In their states, they're often networks of in their own right, bringing together leading citizens and people who are interested in improving education in their states, backed by local leadership and similar investments from local community folks.
What I've always loved about working with Pi Network groups is everyone sort of has this like roll up their sleeves ethos towards policy where everyone's in it really for, I would say, like pretty pure reasons. And it's for the kids and it's for improving their local communities. And it's not, you were on this side, you're on this side. It's if you'll work with us, like we'll work with you and kind of bringing everyone together.
Yeah. And look, it's a remarkable thing. I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, most of these groups did not exist. You know, there were some early ones like Advance Illinois, like the original ConCan, which has now become 50CAN, Stanford Children. Now we've got, you know, Tennessee SCORE. Of course, there's Fordham's Ohio team. Mm-hmm. We've got EdTrust West and Midwest and many, many more all over the country. And these are not groups that are acting as think tanks putting out papers. These are groups that get in there and lobby. They have an advocacy agenda every year that they try to push. Around charter schools or accountability or teacher quality or school finance. And, you know, oftentimes opposed by the teachers unions, but not always. But with this notion that a certain Secretary DeVos used to talk about that, you know, we weren't going to win this debate just writing op-eds. No, that's what I do.
You do it really well, Mike.
Thank you. That we actually had to get out there and get involved in the dirty world of policy and politics. And that's what these groups do. And Suzanne tries to help them do it better.
Well, and the spirit, as Alyssa said, the spirit of the network is many understand that they're in this work for the long haul and that there's know-how and resources that what happens in their states can be shared across state lines to make the work easier, the lifting easier for other people.
All right. So let's talk about how things are going right now. This is a tricky time for many of these organizations, of course. So let's talk about it in Ed Reform Update. So let's talk about how things are going out there, Suzanne, at the state level. Of course, as everybody knows, the Republican Party, dominant though it is in Washington, is even more dominant at the state level right now. You've got something like 2/3 of the states that where the legislature is controlled by Republicans, 2/3 of the states where the governor is Republican. I think half the states where it's all, you know, both houses of the legislature plus the governor are Republicans. And then a handful, really, less than a hand, I think 4 states that are all blue. And yet the cities where a lot of the kids are who education reformers are most concerned about are deep, deep blue. And so somehow you have to patch together strange coalitions in order to, you know, pass laws at the state level, which are largely Republican, serving families and communities in the cities that are heavily Democratic. How on earth are these members navigating this, Suzanne?
Well, it's easy in most immediate world to think everything is strange and new. But in mm-hmm. fact, at the state level, political dynamics mm-hmm. tip and teeter a lot more regularly than we see at the federal level. And so one of the shared bits of wisdom in state level advocacy is that you always want to stay nimble. Most organizations are smart about building their boards of directors and their advisory groups in ways that always have bipartisan mm-hmm. Reach within them and bipartisan mm-hmm. thinkers so that they stay nimble and always have the appearance of always working across the political spectrum.
Now, this has certainly, over the last 12 months, been a difficult time for education mm-hmm. reform, you know, partly because of the bigger politics going on in our country, the crazy 2016 campaign and election, but also because we've been kind of sniping at each other, you know, we've certainly been a part of it here at Fordham, but really it's sniping over things around, you know, differences on ideology, on politics, on race, on many of those issues. Mm-hmm. How do you see this? I mean, is this all just noise that us in D.C. like to chatter and the people at the state level can just ignore it? Or does it have an impact on them?
Oh, gosh. There's layers and layers to answer that question. Well, and the first is, Checker Finn always chuckles when I say I wanted to be a little bit older before I became a voice of history in this work. But yeah. I would argue that the last 8 years have been easier in ed reform than have been true in my career because we've had this very unusual leadership at the national level of a president who reached for a controversial secretary and then appointed a second controversial secretary who was far more amenable to the reform community than he was to the president's own party. And that's a fairly unusual tap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's given us a lot more comfort in the reform world, which is, I think, why there's been a lot more ideological squabbling. What we saw, Mike, when you and I both were starting PI in the early days was a very pragmatic and kind of heads down, nose to the grindstone work ethic within the advocacy sector of people who were working in very sparse environments, very few allies, and just gutting it out. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got a lot more people in the tent. And mm-hmm. so I think that's why things have gotten noisy. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot more pundits. And so I affectionately call the chattering class that can, with less consequence, you know, talk openly on air in forums like this about what they think others ought to do. And the folks mm-hmm. who are working at the state level are much more quiet because they're out there doing the work. So I do think there is mm-hmm. a much noisier layer of conversation than I would have seen back in my day.
That seems to coincide a lot with the rise of Twitter as a medium.
That's
just
fair.
Throwing
fair
that
enough.
Out there.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Yes. Fair enough.
Bad for our national politics. Bad for education reform. Is that it?
But maybe. It's not unusual for there to be a big dust up in mm-hmm. the kind of inner beltway conversation that I'll just be on the phone with state folks who are saying, yeah. What is either what's going on or I didn't even know that was happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe a little bit of who are these crazy people out there in D.C.?
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I'd never even thought of it as the education reform movement has gotten more comfortable, that gives us this space to bump elbows over some of these ideological differences, that it's not just
right. When you
we're
face
getting threats from the outside.
Existential threat, then you tend to rally together more mm-hmm. Maybe than when you don't. Of course, a lot of people right now are feeling existentially threatened by the current administration. So that's putting people on edge as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing, though, is possibly that we're just not sure what's next. I mean, there was an agenda in recent years that was pretty clear. You know, many of these groups are working mm-hmm. on Common Core, first adopting it, then defending it and implementing it. That's been a big part of the work. A lot of people pushing for high quality charter schools, both expanding charters, also bringing quality reforms mm-hmm. like we worked on in Ohio, our great team there in Columbus. You know, there was the teacher evaluation thing that, in my opinion, I'm glad has come and gone. but it's a little unclear. People say, you know, what's next? I mean, yeah, you know, implementing ESSA. But in terms of the next big thing, I don't think it's a problem that there's not a next big thing right now. I think we got to finish what we started, you know, especially, hey, implement these standards, you know, get really good curriculum in place, do what Louisiana's done and actually make sure the teachers have mastered the standards and have a great aligned curriculum. I mean, a lot of good work to be done with that, but it does lead to maybe more squabbling because, you know, we're just not sure what the, you know, what the cause is that we're all supporting.
No, I mean, yes and no. I'd say certainly like we're kind of through, and this is from a fairly limited perspective. Like, we've had a lot of big battles. Those have kind of been fought and won. ESSA has been reauthorized. That was, at least in DC, something huge that people were working on. And so now we're in kind of the tougher nitty gritty, like curriculum reform. Like, DCPS is doing a ton around it. And there are some states, New York and Gage had a really great curriculum, but that's a really like tough and wonky and, I hate the term, but unsexy aspect of reform. So we've got that. But on the other hand, like, there are fewer clear-cut North Stars that we as an ed reform community can rally around these days.
All right. But speaking of sexy, the big sexy right now is $20 billion school choice proposal, which we expect to be coming soon. Suzanne, what advice would you give to Secretary DeVos about how she might engage these Pi Network groups when she rolls out this proposal? I mean, let's imagine that the proposal, and we don't know this yet, but let's imagine that it depends on some kind of state action. That basically, if it's a tax credit thing for scholarships, for vouchers, it relies on states enacting their own tax credit scholarship program. That may not be the case, but let's say it does. And, you know, here are these reform groups out there, you know, who could be encouraged to participate in you know,
in this conversation.
In advocating for this. What should she say to them?
Well, first of all, I'll reach back to lessons I learned humbly and the hard way, working in a place not quite as big as the entire country, but one of the biggest reform environments in the country, California. Where, and this will give you some sense of just how old I am, back when California was passing the baton between blue and red governors. And we, for a moment, had a policymaking environment that was all blue state, but with a reform-minded governor who appointed a very strong state board of ed. And so, bottom line, we could do things fast and quickly, which we did, and didn't build a lot of buy-in. And we had policy, reform policy, on the books in California in code that many people don't even believe ever existed, because it was as wiped out as quickly as it came. So the lesson is, what would I suggest to Secretary DeVos or anybody, even new leadership at the state level, when you're in an environment where it feels like you can run for the, you know, the end zone with abandon, you tend to want to move fast and quick and think you can put a whole bunch of stuff in place. But as hard as passing policy is, that's the easy part. And the hard part is implementing things. And what we've learned, those of us who've been at this a while, is that we need bipartisan commitment. Because things take a much longer time to implement and to sustain over the long time. And to get something from the federal government all the way to a classroom in Peoria or Poughkeepsie or any place in the middle of the country is going to be more than a 4 or 5 year effort.
That's so true. And you look at the states, by the way, that have shown big improvement over time. You know, Massachusetts for a while, and still to some degree, Tennessee more recently. They're places that have
D.C.
Well, it's not a state, but okay.
But stable leadership is the bottom line.
Stable leadership, but also a coherent strategy, bipartisan leadership. I mean, they've gone through transitions in governors and mayors and kept the progress going. And it's pretty remarkable. And you're right. It was because there was some mechanism to get people together, at least in a broad centrist coalition with a vision, oftentimes with the support of outside organizations that are members of PiNet. To stay the course. And that's what we need.
And reaching out for that kind of coalition building takes effort. And then in an environment where it seems like, wow, we've just won the day and everybody around us is like-minded, it can be seductive to think, let's just pass a lot of policy fast. But those instincts need to be cautioned with, you know, the need for building unusual coalitions and reaching out to folks and building strong relationships as broadly as possible to make sure things sustain over time.
All right. Suzanne Tatchney-Kubach, thanks so much for coming. Did I say that right? Kubach?
Nope.
Kubach?
You're not even getting Tatchney right. Suzanne Tatchney, with a soft CH. It's a French Tatchney.
I never knew that.
And a German Kubach. So Suzanne Tatchney-Kubach.
Oh my gosh. Suzanne Tatchney-Kubach. How long have I known you? And I keep butchering that.
Two CHs.
Too long. Thanks so much for coming. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike.
You know, we talked about the Grammys earlier, but of course, coming up this weekend,
the Oscars.
Have you seen any of the movies, Amber?
Let me think. What's up? Tell me what's up.
Oh, my gosh. I'm woefully behind on my Oscars knowledge.
I know.
Hidden Figures.
La La Land, which I am in the Haters Club. Moonlight, which I thought was very good.
So far, I've only seen Hidden Figures.
And Manchester by the Sea.
Didn't see that either.
Arrival, which Brandon I know really likes. It's
I think I've seen most of the animated films.
Yeah.
That are nominated. Yeah, that's the category that.
Well, I saw Secret Life of Pets. Is that up for anything?
I don't think it got nominated.
Secret Life of Pets.
It's Zootopia.
Zootopia is supposed to win that category.
No. Oh. It should be the one with the two strings.
The ropes. The red rope or whatever.
Oh, red rope. What are you talking about?
You've discussed this one before.
Why am I forgetting the name of it?
You played an instrument or something?
Yeah, no. It's Kubo and the Two Strings.
Ah, okay.
Right. I didn't see
that. Utopia was fun. But, you know.
Yeah. But Secret Life of Pets, come on. That was
fun. I enjoyed it.
Missed that one too. See, I'm like,
anyway, well,
all TV
that's my vote.
Days.
And a Hidden Figures was great too.
Yeah. So good.
All right, Amber. What you got?
We got a new study that examines the effects of changing tenure policy in Louisiana. So in 2012, Louisiana passed a law that made tenure contingent on how a teacher performed on what? Her evaluation, right? Evaluation measure. They call the effectiveness measure COMPASS in Louisiana. The law extended the time to tenure and made tenure status contingent upon the performance on COMPASS. Okay?
Yeah. For new teachers.
So, well, for untenured teachers, as of 2012-2013, tenure would be granted only after a teacher received a highly effective COMPASS rating for 5 out of 6 consecutive years.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to stick around.
Okay.
That's a while.
But there wasn't anything about taking... I'll just be quiet.
Also, for any teacher with tenure already, mm-hmm. or you get it in the future, tenure status is revoked if a teacher is rated ineffective once,
mm-hmm.
and then that teacher has to regain tenure by receiving consecutive highly effective ratings again.
So this is a lot like Colorado 191.
Had something in it for the tenured teachers too, okay? Analysts use teacher employment records specifically. They're looking at summer exits from the period before this reform, 2011, compared to teacher exits for 2 years after the reform, 2012-13. Analysts attempt to control for other things that might also be responsible for a change in exit rates, mm-hmm. like the aging workforce, like more challenging working conditions, like Common Core also happened, by comparing teachers with similar characteristics and trying to see whether these other policies lined up to the timing of the reform change.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to do. Okay. It's nearly impossible to control for everything else that might be going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That said,
budget cuts also at
budget
one point.
Cuts. Yeah. Here are the findings. Number one, after the reform, the overall teacher exit rate for all traditional public school teachers increased by 1.5 percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
They estimate in raw numbers that equates to 1,500 to 1,700 who left in the first 2 years after the tenure reform.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, effects were greatest for teachers who were eligible for retirement with immediate full pension benefits.
Mm-hmm.
They were the teachers who tended to have at least 25 years in.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, the increase in teacher exits was highest in schools with the lowest standardized test scores.
Mm-hmm.
So schools with a letter grade of F saw exits increase from 7.4 to 9.4%,
mm-hmm.
while A-rated schools saw no change. And finally, number four, exits for fourth-year teachers. This is, again, the year that normally you'd get tenure, right, mm-hmm. before the tenure mm-hmm. law, because 3 years mm-hmm. you're in, then fourth year, you get it. Jumped 3.6 percentage points after the reform.
Huh.
So these are, again, the teachers that were presumably most impacted. The biggest issue, again, I think, is that they weren't able to control for these other things.
Yeah.
You just can't. Common Core implementation. Mm-hmm. They also apparently had a change in their pension system where... Mm-hmm. I can't remember what it was, but some parallel change that might have incentivized teachers to retire early mm-hmm. anyway. And they also, they don't have effectiveness data.
Oh.
So we don't know whether the teachers who are leaving are the least effective teachers or not.
It's like they stole my first question.
Yeah. Because if they were ineffective, then we're happy that they left.
Sayonara.
Right.
So we have no idea if this is a positive or negative thing on the quality of the workforce.
That seems like a big question.
It is. I'm hoping, because Catherine Strunk is one of our EAPs, and she was the lead investigator here. I'm hoping that they're going to go back and look at that question.
But by saying that, we do know that the schools that were low performing tended to see more teachers exiting. And so it certainly is possible.
Possible.
That those schools are likely almost for sure to have more ineffective teachers.
Right. Yeah. Also, did the Compass evaluations, like it's an evaluation system, so presumably there are teacher rankings somewhere that we could.
Right. But I read Matt Barnum's write-up because I was curious what his takeaway was. And apparently he interviewed Catherine Strunk, and they are still getting really high ratings on Compass, you know, so they're still not getting their differentiation. Another thing they brought up in there is that the teachers who are about to retire and get immediate pension benefits, I mean, presumably they're the ones that would be least impacted, right, by this reform anyway.
Maybe it was, I wondered about that. My, like, immediate thought was it was like, this is another layer of, you know, paperwork or bureaucracy or whatever. Like, we've got our full pension. Let's just cut our losses and go.
Right.
It is so hard to figure this out. I mean, you know, because look, if the goal is get rid of ineffective teachers or teachers who just don't buy in to the notion that student achievement is sort of the big thing we're all after, then again, fine, see ya. On the other hand, you know, if you've got good teachers who any of us would go into their classroom, they're doing great stuff, and they don't trust the Compass system, or they think it's all, you know, a bunch of, you know, bureaucrats in Baton Rouge, you know, coming up with crazy stuff. I mean, then that's a problem. We just, again, we don't know. I mean, and so, yeah, it raises a lot of questions. But look, I am at least cautiously optimistic that this is showing that if, you know, you can nudge some teachers out. I mean, this is the time to do it, is before, especially the part where it's about new teachers, you know, do not give them tenure. If you want to keep a tenure system, okay, but do not give somebody tenure automatically.
Right, right. Well, in the case of DC, which is another thing that was brought up, you know, at least there, you know, we've seen that they've been able to get rid of some of these lesser effective teachers. And they've got a pipeline of effective teachers in the waiting in the wings. Because, by the way, they get a nice performance bonus and they get paid, you know, pretty well in D.C. Yeah. So that's not the case everywhere. So, you know, and Catherine makes the point, look, you know, if we're going to have this level of turnover, and presumably if some of them are least effective, then let's be able to incentivize, you know, the higher performing teachers to get in there. So,
hey, let's point out Louisiana highest, most gains, at least at the fourth grade level of any state on the latest NAEP.
Doing something right.
So they are doing something right indeed. All right. Well, good. Good stuff. Thank you, Amber. Yes, and indeed. I'm impressed too. This was hot off the presses.
Wow. I'm like speed reading half hour ago. Yeah. Like, let me read it
but,
quickly.
But hey, you know, Doug Harris and his team there at Tulane continue to crank out cool stuff.
Absolutely.
So kudos to them. All right. Hey, that is all the time we've got for this week's show. Until next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.